across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you very much for returning to the show. Thank you also for the great comments I've had about Mark L. Cowden, who was our guest on Edition 61. We talked about a case of communication between this world and supposedly the next. I found him a very compelling guest who told an amazing story very, very well. And I recommend him, and I recommend the book. You decide what you think about it for yourself, but I don't think you can fail to be impressed by that story. I certainly was. That's Edition 61, Mark L. Cowden. Let's get on to Edition 62 now. We have on Jim Maroney from Canada. Jim Maroney is, he says, an abductee, an alien abductee. That's right, you've heard these stories many times. You want to hear Jim's, though. I have a little inkling of what is to come, and I think, once again, you need to pour yourself a drink of whatever it is you like. Sit back if you can and listen to his story, because it is amazing. And then, once again, you decide for yourself what you think about it. We have another guest on a similar vein upcoming as well. Micah Hanks will be on here. We'll talk with him soon. But right now, I want to give an hour to Jim Maroney from Canada, because the guy is worth it, and I think you'll be interested by what he has to say. It will make you think. I have a feeling, intuitively, as they say. Now, if you want to get in touch with me, I would love you to give me your reaction to the shows, give me your feedback, tell me what you think, suggest guests, whatever. Go to www.theunexplained.tv. That's our website, www.theunexplained.tv. Created by my webmaster, Adam Cornwell, from Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. Thank you, Adam, for your hard work. There you can contact me. You can also make a donation. Do whatever. Please enjoy the site. And if you have any suggestions for the site, let me know too. Thank you to Martin once again for the theme tune. Martin, we need to be in touch very soon. I hope everything's all right with you. And as I always say, thank you very much to you for being involved in this show. The best favor that you could do for me, apart from getting in touch through the website, is please spread the word about this show. We are a tiny, tiny little operation. We're not part of some big corporation or anything, really. It's just me and you and Adam in the middle, the intermediary between us. And that's the whole thing, the whole kit and caboodle of The Unexplained. Isn't that great? All right, let's get on now. The guest, Jim Maroney from Canada, abductee. Jim Maroney, thank you very much for coming on The Unexplained.
Well, thank you very much, Howard, for having me on. I'm excited.
Whereabouts are you exactly?
I currently, right now, am speaking to you from London, Ontario, Canada.
Now, I've often heard of London, Ontario. I've never been there. I know a few things about it, but what's it like? Give me a quick potted picture.
Well, actually, it's beautiful right now. It's a small community, probably about a small community compared to London, England. It's got around about 700,000 people.
Okay, nice size. Nice size. Big enough to get around, not too big to get lost in.
That's correct.
Now, all right, the other remarkable thing about you, apart from the fact that you live in London, Ontario, is the number of initials you have after your name. What's that all about?
Well, my profession is in health and safety. So through my career, I went into sciences originally. I went to college and I went to university, and I concentrated on health sciences, general sciences. And when I graduated, I went on to get certifications both in Canada and in the United States for health and safety. So essentially, they're health and safety certification designations.
Well, let me tell you, I was very, very impressed. I thought I was going to be talking to Albert Einstein here.
Yeah, I wish.
All right, that explains all the initials. Yeah. I think we ought to cut to the chase, because you are described to me in the various descriptions I see of you as an abductee. Now, that is a word I love, because over the years, I've spoken to quite a number of people who have claimed to know abductees, have claimed to know or have been involved in the bringing up, in one case, of hybrids, have had contact with aliens insofar as they have seen them or have seen things in the sky. But I have never talked to somebody who says that they're an abductee. Is that your description for yourself?
I would have to say yes. You know, really, it's probably the classical definition that would, of course, we're kind of, in the years following, I think we're going to redefine what an abductee actually is, but currently, I would say that would be adequate, yes.
Before we get into it, is that one abduction experience, because some people have one and that's it for the rest of their lives, some people claim to be serial abductees. Which one are you?
I'd be the serial one. I think I'd fall into that case.
Really?
Yep.
So they've been for you a few times?
Yes, yeah.
Do you think they want to know about health and safety?
I think they probably know all about it, a lot more than me.
All right. Tell me your story then, your background in this. Were you before you had those experiences, which we will get into, were you interested in all this stuff, or is this something that came knocking on your door?
It was really something that came knocking on my door, Howard. I had previously thought about, this was way back in 1987, years and years and years ago, you know, before I really understood anything about this phenomenon. And I thought that, yes, you know what, maybe there was some validity to some UFO sightings. I had already assumed that some, you know, were cranks or quacks with respect to sightings. I thought that, but I also thought that there seemed to be some merit to some of the sightings and reports of UFOs. But I had really no idea about abductions or encounter experiences. In fact, I really concluded that, at least this is just my own rational reasoning, I thought that, well, if there was extraterrestrial life out there, and there probably was, and if there were UFOs that were visiting Earth, they were pretty much like us, maybe just more technologically advanced. But that is honestly the short and the long of it. I mean, that's as much thought as I've ever put into it, and I never really concentrated on it. I wasn't really drawn to it in any major way at all.
So in other words, you were an ordinary Joe, just like the rest of us.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, completely.
Then what happened?
Well, in 1987, I had this experience that completely shattered every preconceived idea or notion I had about the phenomenon, and completely decimated what I would call my consensus reality. And that is, you know, what I thought the world was, or I thought that the reality that I was familiar with suddenly liquefied underneath my feet, and I found myself swimming in a pool of of questions and a whole different reality to the one that I was familiar with. And it took some time to get my feet, I'd say, back on the ground, to get myself grounded again. And I never spoke to people publicly about my experiences because, you know, they're very personal experiences, and I didn't think I would probably even do it justice. And then the other part of it was that I didn't really have a good reason to tell anybody about it until a little bit later on in my life, where I felt that the reason and the purpose for me telling the story was that this is an experience that many of us are going to have in the future, and that we need to start to at least start moving into a direction of a greater scientific understanding of it, and to also try and work to bring some credibility to the study of the science.
All right. Well, before I unpick that and ask you the second part of your statement there, or ask you about it, where you say that a lot of us are going to have this experience, let's hear about yours.
Well, back in 1987, I was traveling between two cities, Edmonton and Sarnia, Ontario, and the distance between these two cities is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 2,500 kilometers.
Wow.
And so I wasn't going to make it in one day.
Do you know, but we don't have distances like that here. I can't imagine. I can imagine flying that, but I can't imagine sort of driving that.
Yeah, it's a long drive. It'll take a good 3 days of driving,
okay.
A real good 3 days. So my first leg of the journey was about 11 hours drive. So by the time I arrived in this, about central Canada, essentially, it was a little truck stop just south of a city called Winnipeg. I know, a really odd name for a city. But the city is about 1 million people or so, and I pulled into a truck stop which was off a major transportation route called Highway 1. It's called the Trans-Canada Highway. It's a highway that links, goes across the entire continent, essentially. And I pulled into this truck stop, and I tried to get some sleep. You know, I'm thinking of it now as quite humorous because, you know, if you're in a transport truck, it's a good place to maybe grab some sleep. If you're in a little Honda Civic, which I was at the time, It's not the best place to try and get some sleep.
No, listen, Jim, I think a little Honda Civic is never a good place to try and get some sleep in. But there you go.
Yeah, so the transport trucks were pulling in all night, and, you know, it was difficult. I couldn't get any sleep. The transport trucks continued to pull in, and, you know, the noise of them and the lights of them and everything. So here I am, lying in my car, and I was in the passenger side of the vehicle because I had to get the pedals out of the way, get the steering wheel out of the way. So I pulled myself over to the passenger side, put the seat back, stretched out my legs, put a blanket over top of me, and cracked the window just ever so slightly just to get a little bit of air in. And the mosquitoes were coming into the car, and I thought, oh my God, this isn't going to work. Killed the mosquitoes that were in the car, rolled up the window. And as I was lying there trying to get some sleep, a transport truck pulled in really close to me, and I'm thinking, what is this idiot doing? He's got his, you know, he must be pulling right up in front of my car because his lights are blasting into my car, and the intensity was so bright, and I'm thinking, this guy is going to be like an inch away from my car by the time he finishes parking. And then I realized that the lights were moving over top of the car. And I had my eyes closed at this time because just the intensity of the light. And I realized, yeah, these lights were actually moving over top of the car. I had a little sunroof. Hard to believe Honda Civics come with sunroofs back
So at that time, you thought that there was a truck next to you. And then you thought the truck was somehow rolling over the top of your car, complete with sunroof.
Well, I thought it was a truck, but as soon as those lights started moving over top, I knew it wasn't a truck.
What did you think it might be? Did you think it was a low-flying plane?
I knew it wasn't a low-flying plane because almost instantaneously, as these lights were moving over top of the car, an incredible paralysis overtook me. And I wasn't able to move. And then this fear, which I would have to say is external to me, maybe it's part of this paralysis process, overtook me as well. Now, my mind was racing, you know, and I'm trying to make sense of what's going on. And I said, well, whatever craft is over top of this vehicle, it's somehow paralyzed me, obviously. And there is this incredible, how to describe it, an electromagnetic energy in the air. And I could feel my hairs on my arm actually begin to rise, you know, like you're in this really intense electromagnetic field. And so I'm thinking, okay, whatever, you know, device that's being used. And it was silent, completely silent. And I can only describe the air as like being dead air. It was as if sound transmission was somehow being inhibited in some way. And as this paralysis, this wasn't a gentle paralysis by any means. This was an intense, debilitating paralysis. I was concerned whether or not I could continue to breathe. I rationalized to myself as my mind's racing, I'm thinking, whatever is above me and I'm thinking it must be some beings of some sort, that they must be intensely concerned about what I am or who I am in order for that paralysis to be that debilitating. In other words, they're afraid that I'm going to be doing something that might hurt them or do something irrational or unexpected. And I thought that whatever I do, you know, don't do anything stupid, Jim. You know, don't jeopardize my life. Don't do something that's going to put my life in danger here. And then suddenly I felt this feeling of being drawn forward, which was very odd. I'm in this really small, cramped car, and all of a sudden I'm being drawn forward and up. And I'm thinking, well, this isn't going to work. You know, I'm going to hit the windshield. And I just passed right through the windshield as if the windshield was water. It was, I don't understand how their technology works.
All right, so during that experience, what a lot of us would tend to think, because we have these kinds of experiences at night, well, I certainly do, maybe I'm being abducted, but I tend to think, am I asleep? Am I half asleep? Am I really awake?
Yeah. Those ideas never entered into my mind for one second during this experience, because the intensity of the experience and the fact that I hadn't been able to fall asleep, I was completely lucid, completely awake at this time. Yeah, completely. And so there wasn't any doubt that it actually happened. But I got to tell you, afterwards, there was, you know, you in order to kind of deal with the experience, there were times I actually wished that I was sleeping. You know, maybe it didn't actually happen to me, but it's lying to me when I thought, you know, when I started thinking that way, I knew really what happened. I knew the reality of that particular experience, and I had to come to terms with that experience.
I have to say, even people who think they're brave would probably be really scared.
You know, I always thought of myself, Howard, as kind of a courageous guy, but I got to tell you, man, my courage went somewhere that night. It certainly wasn't with me. You know, I was as scared as I've ever been in my life. Yeah, no doubt about it.
I'm almost scared to ask the question, what happened then?
Well, I only had fragments of my memory. And I'm going to, rather than tell you just all the fragments of my memory, because then I had to go back and go through hypnotic regression to kind of put the other pieces that were missing together. But essentially what happened is I found myself standing, as I got pulled through the car, it was really uncomfortable. I felt as my body was being ripped apart. I felt there's bubbles in my blood. It felt really, really uncomfortable. I thought I was dying, essentially. I thought I was being torn apart. And then the next instant, no pain, and I'm standing in this amphitheater with non-human beings in front of me. So, you know, and as I stagger back and I put my hand down and I touch an object and I look, and there's my vehicle right beside me.
Right beside you?
Yeah, my vehicle, my little Honda Civic.
You mean they brought that with you?
They brought that with me inside this craft.
How big was this thing?
It was enormous. You know, as I walked through the craft, I tried to look out through a window, tried to get an idea where I was and what the size of the craft was, and there was no windows. So I don't even know how large this craft was. But the feeling was as if I was walking in a large hospital. So who you know, the rooms, the hallways themselves were straight, so there wasn't any bend or gentle bend to them to give me a sense of if it was a symmetrical or non-symmetrical vehicle, if it was, you know, the general size of it. The ceilings were very comfortably high. I mean, they were 8.5-foot ceilings generally, and in fact, some of the rooms were actually, I'd say, about 2 stories high. It was an enormous craft, whatever it was.
And did you have, I presume you did, of some sort of James Bond moment, you know, where James Bond is captured by the bad guy, he wakes up in this place, and then the villain says, "Good morning, Mr. Bond." Did you have that kind of moment? I don't want to be flippant about this, but you know what I'm saying.
Well, you know what happened is that, here, you know, for a minute I was originally thinking, Jim, don't do anything stupid, you know, don't do anything that's going to put your life at risk. You know, wherever you're entering into a very unknown situation, it's going to be very tenuous. Don't do anything unexpected that's going to jeopardize your life. That's really what I was telling myself. Well, the next thing I know, you know, I'm standing there. Now, I'd been hurt by being brought in this place. And I look at these beings in front of me, and they're obviously non-human beings. And the first thing I start doing is swearing and yelling at them, you know, and I'm being very indignant. I'm telling them, you know, what are you guys doing? You guys got no right to do this, you know. And part of me was thinking, like, boy, if they hurt me bringing me onto the ship, you know, maybe these guys don't know what the heck they're doing.
But hold on. Up to that point, these beings, for want of another word, had not uttered any kind of word to you. They hadn't communicated with you.
Nope, not at all. They were just looking at me in the... just these large blue eyes. They had blue pupils. All of them had blue pupils. It was the same kind of color, essentially, that existed between all of them. I didn't see any color differentiation between any of the beings that I saw with their respect to their eyes. So it wasn't the black eyes that some people report, you know, or all these compound eyes.
And what about them themselves? Were they gray?
They had a grayish skin color, but they had uniforms that they were wearing.
Kind of uniforms?
Like, yeah, I'd say like jumpsuits kind of thing. And they were all the same. Well, the ones I had seen originally there that were standing in front of me had all similar kind of uniforms, essentially a similar kind of like color to it. I'd call it maybe like a khaki kind of color to it. And they were about 3.5 feet tall. So they weren't particularly, you know, large or anything like that.
So up to this point, you'd sworn at them. You were a little scared for your safety, but did you not wonder at that point, one, what am I doing here? Two, who are these people? Three, what are they going to do?
I did, but more so for that point, the overwhelming feeling that dominated was just get out of this thing alive. And first thing I needed to do was try and set some kind of basis for some kind of relationship, which basically mean I didn't want them to hurt me again. So I'm being quite indignant, you know, and I was yelling at them, screaming at them, telling them, getting quite angry. And I think anger is now just, it's a part of that fear that you have sometimes when you get angry. It's just, you know, that your fear dominates some of your more rational thinking that should have taken place. But one of the beings, and I remember yelling at them and saying, you know, you could have used the door, you know, assuming that the reason why I felt all this pain and everything being brought on ship was because they had to take me through the solid material, and I thought maybe this dematerialization process or whatever caused all this pain for me. And I said, you know, you could have used the door. And I remember one of the beings very distinctly stepping forward and in perfect English, without an accent that I could discern, gave a question. The question was, what do you need doors for? And the question was so out of the ordinary. The fact that they spoke English, I mean completely auditory English, was lost with the fact that I didn't know how to answer the question. I'm like, what do we need doors for?
Well, that was the accent. What about the tone of voice? What do you think he or she or it meant by that?
It was felt like a male. I'm not sure what they meant by it. I was so stunned by the question. It just stopped me. And I went, well, if we don't even have doors in common, how am I going to communicate with these guys?
You would get that feeling, wouldn't you? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
So, then I started getting more angry again, and another being stepped forward, and then at the snap of a finger, I was completely calm. So they had this ability to project some control over me. And if you think of maybe standing up in front of a hypnotist and getting hypnotized in some way and having the hypnotist give you suggestions about how to act or how to do things, they really had this ability to do that. You know, they're not just more intelligent than us. They had this, it's a different type of consciousness. So they were able to control me in some way. And so one second I'm really angry, bang, the next second, completely calm. And then they said, well, you need to come with us. And I went, okay. You know, without questioning it any further, without getting angry, and I just followed them. And as I was following them, I was looking around the ship, trying to, you know, determine where I was, how large the ship was. And I remember one thing that really struck me was that the size of the ship, and as I was walking through the hallways, and I'm looking at the halls, I'm thinking, gosh, you know, these hallways are huge. They're wide. They're like 8.5 feet tall, or 8.5 feet tall and about 9 feet wide. I said, boy, this craft is large. These hallways are huge. And then what really struck me was that the size of these beings was not consistent with the size of the ship.
Exactly what I was going to say. What do they need a craft that is that big for when they're little guys of 3 foot tall, whatever?
Exactly. And this is why I struck me and said, oh my God, the dimensions in this ship were anthropometrically perfect for dealing with human beings. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I said, I think this ship is designed specifically with the intent of dealing with human beings. This is not designed directly for their needs. And in fact, the ship was very clean. You know, it was almost antiseptic in that sense. You know, it was just very, very clean, very bright inside as well. And it was obviously extremely large, as I mentioned earlier. And I remember looking down a hallway, and another hallway that we passed that interjected this other hallway I was walking on, and it was quite large as well. And I was just amazed about the size of this thing. And I was walked into a room with another two beings that were waiting for me, and they were dressed in a kind of like white, I'll call them white lab coats. So they were dressed differently than the other beings that were with me.
So at that point, you must have been starting to put two and two together and making six or eight, because you start to think, well, this is in our kind of dimensions. And now here are a couple of guys with white coats. They're going to do research on me.
Yeah, I'm thinking, uh-oh, you know. And I remember hesitating. I really did. I stopped at this door as the door opened up, and it was like a pocket door. It slid over. The edges were round on this door, and again, a typical door, the ones that you you would see, you know, in a house, right? Typical dimensions. But again, that was a pocket door that slid through. And there's two beings that were waiting for me, and then I walked into this room, and I looked up, and the room was large. It was about two stories high. There was, and there was a lot of equipment that was in this room, and there were people or beings moving around on the top.
And you were sure you were conscious at this time?
Oh, completely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely. And they proceeded to do some medical procedures on me, and it was pretty uncomfortable. And then I would leave that particular room, and I went into another room where they did some more tests on me and some more other medical, I'll call them medical procedures, for lack of a better term.
All right, well, within the realms of a family audience, what kind of stuff were they doing?
Well, I know some people think, oh, my God, have you been anal probed or something like
that? Well, yeah, exactly. I'm too polite to ask, but, that's what I'm thinking.
I don't, thank God I don't recall that particular type of, thing, if it was ever done. I don't recall it. But I do recall that there was a device that was pushed into my side.
Into your side?
Yeah, my side. The side of my abdomen, sorry.
Through your flesh?
Yep.
Like a knife? Like what? Like a skewer?
It would be like if someone took their finger and pushed really hard into your side. And then I could feel it go into my side, like go inside internally.
Did this hurt?
Yeah, it hurt. It was uncomfortable. But it wasn't excruciating in any way, but it was really uncomfortable. But it wasn't excruciating. And I thought, oh, my God, I was helpless to move at this point, where I was in this table. I, again, the paralysis came over me, and I just wasn't able to move, and I could feel it pushing in. And then I could feel it do something internally, and then it pulled out, and there was no blood. There was no scar tissue. There wasn't any scarring there at all. So whatever technology they're using, I'm not, it's obviously medically far more advanced than what we have.
I have to ask this. Did they take anything away?
I don't know if the device actually removed something that was in there or implanted something that was in there.
Right. So it could have been one of the two. You didn't look.
Yeah, I didn't look. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, I can't blame you for that.
Yeah, I wasn't going to be looking at that. I remember even at that time, I had just had my eyes closed. I remember at one point, I started panicking. I remember being left alone briefly as I was sitting there in this area. And I just curled up like a little kid, and I started bawling. And I could feel this intense emotional breakdown essentially occurring in myself, and all of a sudden, bang, I remember thinking to myself, I need help here, I need some help. And almost instantaneously there was this, oh, I'm sorry, and I was calm again. And so one of the beings came over to try and calm me down, and they did it very, very quickly. But that feeling of this, I would call it this, mental overwhelming breakdown just starting to occur, was really, really something. And I'd never obviously felt anything like that in my life, but I didn't believe that an experience could be so overwhelming that would have that kind of effect on somebody.
Did you start to think at that point, when is this going to be over?
Yeah, I was still worried about whether or not I was going to get out of there alive. I mean, that did pass my mind. I was thinking, my God, am I ever going to be back home again? Am I ever going to find my way back home? But it was, I think, was also the other part of it, was that there was some compassion on their part. He did say, oh, I'm sorry, and tried to calm me down, and managed to do that relatively quickly. I also found myself in they took me to this room where it's some kind of, I'll call it an intense experiment, but a procedure that was, felt like an electric shock that went through my body. And it was so painful. I remember hearing, I remember screaming as a result of this particular medical procedure that they were doing. And I blacked out. I'm not sure for whether it was because of the pain or what happened, but I completely went unconscious. When I came to, I was lying on a bed, and there was this being in front of me, again, another a white lab coat, and this being pulls back, and my eyes start to refocus, you know, and I try to get up a little bit, and I'm a little bit weak, and I look around the room. The room is huge. It's like a gymnasium. And in this large room, there's about 70 beds. And in the 70 beds, there's about 30 of them that have people on them. So there's 30 other human beings in this room with me. And at the very foot of my bed are two very large alien beings, which were anthropometrically similar in how they're designed, I'll call it that way, as the other ones that I'd seen, except these beings were not small. These guys were about 10 feet tall.
And 10 feet, so we're talking about a hierarchy.
Yeah, they're not mammalian. I don't believe so. I think they probably may have more like an insect biology to them then.
So there you are with 30 of your friends who you've never met, and these small guys and now some very big guys.
Yeah.
This would be the point that I would probably freak out. I have to say, I'm not ashamed of saying it, I would.
Yeah, this happened very fast. You know, I was still trying to figure out how I'm going to get out of here alive. You know, I'm trying to control my emotions. I'm trying to control myself. And, you know, when I saw those people that were lying there, I remember thinking to myself, I don't want to see this.
And were the 30 other people, were they looking at you? Were they aware of you?
No, they weren't aware of me at all, and they weren't looking at me. They appeared to be in sleep. They appeared to be sleeping. And I remember, you know, one had a plaid shirt on, really unusual. I can still see that in my mind, you know, just a plaid shirt. And there was another person that looked like they had a nightgown. And they were all of all ages, you know, and it was disturbing to see them there. You'd think that seeing another human being in that environment might be a good thing, but it brought no solace to me.
Well, if they're not aware of you and they appear to be resting or whatever, then I guess you think, well, they're obviously keeping them here. They're going to keep me too.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if they were still going to let me go. You know, I'm hoping to get out of there. And as these beings, as these two large beings, I would call them guards. I think that's really what I assessed them as. They were, you know, intently staring at me, and I didn't have any paralysis. You know, as I was coming to, so I believe that they were there to ensure that I didn't hurt anybody, and they released a paralysis, and then this one being steps forward. She's about maybe just 5 feet, maybe 4 foot, 10, somewhere in that neighborhood. She steps forward, and she says, I'll call it like a mannequin kind of voice, you know, without any discernible facial expressions, but she says, "We don't understand your anger." And I'm thinking, what? You know? And you know when you're looking at somebody, you're trying to communicate with somebody, you try and pick up on their body language, you try and pick up on the tone of voice, and I'm struggling trying to read this, and I can't read anything. I can't pick up on any emotions. And she steps forward again and says, "We don't understand your anger." And I'm still trying to clear my head, trying to figure out what's she asking? Like, I'm not angry right now. And then I started thinking, I thought, oh, first of all, I got really angry when I got on the ship. I think that's probably what it must be. The other part of it was, during parts of this experience, I was asking them, you know, is there anything I can help you with? You know, what do you guys need? And I was trying to find some way to communicate with them so that, you know, we could develop some kind of rapport. And, you know, I wish I could say I was so courageous to do this. I was just really, I believe, just trying to find a way to develop some kind of relationship with them so that I could communicate in a way that would ensure that I'm going to get out of there alive.
So there they are trying to understand your anger. There's you trying to communicate with them that you were angry then, but you're not now, and you want to take this thing forward and go home.
Yes, exactly. And as I'm thinking this, I thought to myself, well, you know, whatever's happened, whatever they did to me is done. I need to really think about this for a second. And I thought, look, I'm sorry. I said, you know, I wasn't expecting it to hurt. This is what I wanted to say. You know, I when I got hurt, I got angry. I said, that's, you know, but all I got out was, I'm sorry. And then I felt this immense emotion coming up, and I remember glancing away from her, and I tried to talk a little bit more, and I tried to say, you know, I wasn't expecting it to hurt, but all I got out was, I'm sorry. And then this absolute incredible love and compassion came from this being, overwhelming me. And I cried. I grabbed her and hugged her, and she hugged me. And I remember I didn't want to cry. You know, I didn't want to start bawling again. And I was crying and just like a baby. And I remember her holding on to me, and she whispered into my ear. She says, "That's okay to cry. The strong ones cry," is what she said. Mm. And I also remember then that we spoke for a little while afterwards. So what would have happened is that she was really testing me. She was trying to figure out, you know, who this Jim Maroney guy really is. You know, has he, you know, what kind of a person is he? It was staged. It was carefully, you know, it was a careful plan that was put in place, a very strategic plan on their part.
So they probed your body, and now they're probing your mind.
Yeah, they wanted to find out, like, who I was, you know, what I was, what kind of a person, you know, who is this Jim Maroney guy anyway? What's he like? You know, how does he handle really difficult situations? How does he handle situations where he gets hurt, you know, or situations he doesn't understand very well? What kind of a person is he? And as we, you know, as I was trying to get my composure, and it did take some time for me to get my composure, as I felt that all the stress of the entire experience was just being healed in some way, that I was being able to get rid of it, you know, to release it. I remember her saying to me at one point, she said, you know, "I wish I could stand beside you to face the things that you're going to have to face." And I looked at her and I said, "That's okay." And I said, I understand.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a really intense emotional experience as well, you know. And all these beings, which I thought were so task-orientated, you know, so distant to me, became like friends. There was a real joy. There was also a real sadness that was mixed in with that. There was a lot of emotion that was actually being displayed both by them and by me.
But well, this is all good in a way, but the words that I don't like, and I would worry if I heard those words, were, you know, I'm sorry about what you're going to have to face. Or yeah. I wish I could go through what you're going to have to face with you. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah.
What did you have to face?
I believe it's what I'm going to have to face, what we're all going to have to face in the coming years. My sense now is that what we're dealing with is not contact in the traditional sense that we originally thought it was, or how it was going to take place. And this has really thrown science for a loop. What we're really dealing with is an intervention. And if we look at it from that perspective, it starts to make sense. We can start to put the pieces of this tremendous puzzle together. And in this intervention, there's an intervention into human evolution. From their perspective, our spiritual development has somehow been retarded, and our technological development has exceeded our spiritual development, which has created this imbalance that's going to come to a head in our lifetime. And they sense that without some kind of intervention, which involves this medical process to some extent, you know, humanity may not survive this transition.
Now, is that them saying that to you, or is that you extrapolating from what you experienced that?
It's a bit of both. It's a sense of that, of when I was there with them. They have this way to communicate in a way that's really unusual. One of the things that they were able to do is, if they wanted to tell me something, rather than voice it to me in English or anything else like this, what they were able to do is that they have this ability to link with your mind and to show you something. So one minute you're standing there looking at them, the next instance you're with a friend seeing something in the future. It's a most remarkable experience. It's like a dream, but it isn't a dream. Mm. And so they have this ability, I believe, to perceive future events and then to link with another consciousness like ours and bring that consciousness with them to show them what they're seeing. And
well, I have to say, if I was assuming they are superior, and from the sounds of the technology, they sound like they probably are.
Yeah.
If I wanted to give this human race of ours right now a message, that would be a very good one to give, because I know so many people now who feel that technology, and I sound like a real old guy saying this, but technology is getting out of hand. We know a lot, but maybe we know too much for our ability to be able to handle what we know. So there's a good message there if that's the message they're trying to put across.
Yes, yeah, that's their perception of it. The other part of it is that, you know, we have to take responsibility for the world that we exist in. You know, we're not to look to them to save our planet. You know, we have to look to each other. I think the ultimate feeling is that each single one of us is incredibly important to the outcome of the world, you know, and the new world that's going to happen in the next maybe, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now.
So while you were there with them and the other people, did they give you a clue of where they were from, what they were all about? Apart from that mission statement that you came away with, do you know any more about them?
No. You know, they never felt that that was important. Their sense was that it's more important for this moment right now and for you to understand this.
Well, doesn't that leave you in your psyche, in your consciousness, with a great big chunk of unfinished business? And we human beings know that one thing that really gets people screwed up is unfinished business. There are questions that you don't have answered there.
You bet it does. And that's what really set me on the path of discovery and took me into 25 years plus with research into the UFO phenomenon, because I realized that my experience should not be considered in isolation. You know, it has to be considered in the greater context of the human experience. And we need to be able to look at it in a different way. And this is an evolving process as well. So it's also changing. We should be looking at different cultures.
All right. So that's where you're at now. We left you there on the spaceship. And it's me who sidetracked you here. But how did you get away from there?
It was just time. You know, I remember being brought back to the vehicles in this amphitheater. And I remember standing there and giving that hug to this one being that I had been speaking with, and I gave her a big hug again, and there's this real sense of sadness, you know, and the other beings were around me, and they were happy and they were also sad. I would consider the feeling like they were like my good friends. I also had a sense that this other being that was with me, this one that was more intimate, I suppose, with me in that way of sharing her feelings. I sensed that she had known me for a long time before this experience. I really believe now that they'd had previous contact with me. I just didn't remember it. I had no recollection that I had any encounter experiences in my life. But now I have to conclude that I think the probability that I have had previous contact with these beings is really, really likely.
Which explains your statement at the beginning that you are a repeat offender. You're a serial abductee.
Yeah. Yeah, and they did come to me afterwards. You know, since that experience in 1987, I've had a few experiences with them. Not very many, thank God, you know, really, because they're intense experiences, but not very many. You know, sometimes it's a very odd feeling. You know, sometimes you really wish you'd have experiences with them, and other times you're praying that that you don't. But anyway, I'm on the ship. We have these feelings and that, and I remember walking towards the vehicle, and I remember, oh my God, you know, I don't want them to push me back in my vehicle again the way they took me out. And I remember jumping forward and grabbing the car door and saying, it's okay, guys, I got the door. You know, I'll show you how the door works. And I remember sliding into the passenger side, you know, and putting the blanket over me and putting myself back. And then the vehicle was, with me in it, was dropped back off in the exact same place where I had parked it earlier.
Now, you said some of this experience had to be decoded later through hypnosis. So how much of it did you know when you were back in the car park?
Well, a big part, all the medical experiences and the painful medical experiences, I didn't remember. I believe what they did is they wanted me to forget a lot of what I'd seen, you know, with respect to seeing them, seeing the other people on the ship and seeing and recalling the medical experiences. They wanted me to forget that. They felt that it was important for me to forget about it because they didn't want that to hamper me or hurt me in any way. It was a way that of protecting me. And so, you know, consciously, I absolutely recall being drawn onto the ship and being dropped back from the ship as well. You know, that's completely lucid, 100% conscious memories. The other experiences, it took me about 3 months or so to get the courage to go through hypnotic regression and to recall or recount some of the other experiences that I've had. with them. So
now, from what I read about you, Jim, you have and had a family that you had to return to. It has to go through your mind, all right, am I going to tell them? And if I'm going to tell them, what am I going to tell them? And are they going to think I'm nuts?
Yeah, absolutely. That really ran through my mind right at the very beginning. I didn't want to tell anybody about it. I knew how it would sound. So I'm thinking, I'm not going to tell anybody about this experience, regardless of how real it was. I'm not going to. They're going to think I'm nuts. I have a science background, and I'm thinking, I don't have any physical evidence to be able to prove it. I'm thinking, my God, this is, so what am I going to do with this? But I did eventually confide in my sisters. I remember speaking with her about a week after this experience. And as soon as I tried to talk to her about it, I started crying. I remember this just emotion came out of me, which was really unexpected, to be honest with you. After we talked for a while, I realized that I didn't really have to tell anybody about it. I'll find my peace with this experience, and I'll try and put the pieces together, and I'll try and understand it in a way that I can incorporate this experience so that it's not a debilitating experience in any way, but it just adds to the mystery of my life and to the mystery of everybody's life.
And you've spent 25 years making sense of it.
Yes, in a sense, I've done that, absolutely. And, keeping track of the phenomenon, trying to sort out, the good stuff the good reports from the bad reports, trying to put and piece this incredible puzzle together in a way that we could lucidly discern what's happening and maybe even make predictions about where it's going to be going.
Now, the great test of what you went through and its veracity, for want of another word, is whether other people who report abduction experiences report the same thing. If they do and they don't know you, something happened to you.
Yes, yeah.
So you've done research. Is that the case?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I've started, some of the great work that's already been done in this field has been done by a gentleman by the name of John E. Mack, a Harvard psychiatrist that had originally investigated this phenomenon and came to the conclusion that the phenomenon itself was a real phenomenon. In other words, that these experiences were actually happening. And this was, it sent shockwaves through his profession and had a lot of people essentially, question his credibility, but he defended his credibility, adamantly. So I think that it's not just individuals who are reporting this, there's a real science behind this as well. And my experience is consistent with some of that scientific research, for sure.
Strange question, but there's a point behind it. Do you consider yourself... you'd have to be if you've been through this thing, but do you consider yourself to be different? Is your outlook on the world, on yourself, on everything that happens around you and your family, is it different now?
It is different. But I also... I'd say one of the biggest changes, and this may sound unusual, but I have a much greater sense that we are all connected than I am different than anybody else. It's an experience that draws me closer to other people than I had been previously. I understand that my world vision is different now than it has been also in the past as well. I'm more content in my life. I'm more peaceful in my life.
You sound incredibly calm, and you tell this amazing story in such a matter-of-fact way. And you don't sound nuts. You sound really calm. It is quite remarkable. That's why I asked you that question, because it sounds to me as if that's the change they made in you.
It may be. It may have. I believe we have people out there like yourself, like me, and like many of your listeners, who have the courage, the capacity to experience these things and to build a relationship with beings that we may not have known previously.
Well, that comes to the $64 question. That's the question that all of us would ask after something like this. You're going to come away from that, or maybe even during it, you say, why did they pick me?
Yeah. I believe that event, what I call, was an initiating event, that they had determined and evaluated that was an appropriate time for me to remember these experiences and to remember that particular experience. I believe that if they are interacting with other people, and they certainly are, that they will choose those events. They'll choose a certain time when people should remember these experiences. In other words, many millions of people are having these experiences, but we just don't remember them. It's really a selective process where they decide that, okay, here's an appropriate time for you to remember them. And that being said, I believe in the long term what they want with us is an intimate relationship. They want what they're interested in is that they're being drawn to individuals. They're being drawn to particular people, to individuals, and then into relationships with these individuals. You know, they're not interested in our technology unless it's more destructive and how we're going to hurt ourselves with it.
Well, they, by the sounds of it, they've got their own.
Yeah, they got their own. They've really got their own. So, when you really think about it and you understand their emotion when I'm in their presence, it seems to me quite natural that they would be drawn to us as individuals. You know, we're pretty interesting people. You know,
if you look back at the Betty and Barney Hill case, for example, I mean, they came away with a star map that turned out later to be correct, and they had more of a sense of where the beings that had contact with them had come from, as far as I recall this thing. Now, yep. You don't have that. Is that not a frustration for you?
Not really. There was a gentleman who had reported an experience in the Amazon, and what struck me about his experience was that when he asked them where they were from, their response was, "We are from everywhere." And to him, it was really disconcerting because he associated, and they, in his culture, that you are from where you're from, so that they can put some kind of classification over what kind of a person you are and that kind of thing. To say you're from everywhere is really difficult to get your head around.
So does it indicate they may be interdimensional, as we would say today?
Yeah, and I think that their viewpoint is that from their point of view, you know, they're just part of the universe. You know, there isn't an ownership to one particular place or anything else. They're just part of the universe now. That's their sense of it. That would be I would perfectly expect that that's kind of the response I would get from them if I was to ask them that.
Has it made you think at all about what happens to you when you die?
Yes, yeah, I would think so. I'm not sure I'm going to... I'll know them maybe a little bit before I die, but I'm hoping that when I do pass away and go into another world or wherever our next life will bring us, that I leave this world in a better place than even when I came into it, you know, and that I did something that's going to make a difference and that's going to alleviate the suffering in some way in people's lives. So,
25 years down the track or thereabouts, I'm assuming they are, because it's 25 years down the track, your family are cool about all of this?
They've come to, you know, yeah, they've come to accept it. I've been very careful about protecting them. I mean, I had to talk to my wife about even going public with this. I was concerned what the implications might be, obviously with my career as well. And I took a lot of time to think about it, but they're good with it, you know. They love me and I love them, and they know I'm a pretty grounded guy, obviously, and I just want to make sure I don't do anything that's going to hurt them in the long term. So
that sounds like a good attitude. And you didn't get fired?
Didn't get fired. You know, I went to my board of directors and even told them that I was going to be writing a book before I even published it, and if they had any concerns, that they should talk to me about it, and I would be willing to converse with them on that. And you know, and they said, "No, Jim, you know, you're fine. You know, I'm good at my job, and I've developed a lot of credibility over the years and confidence. I'm a straight-up guy." So they were, you know, they just said, "No, Jim, go ahead." And I told them, I said, "This is just something I want to do on the side, guys. It's kind of like a hobby." It's the way I downplayed it that way. Obviously, I'm very passionate about it. But they were fine with it. So
now, I know you've written about this phenomenon. You've talked about it extensively. You've publicized it a lot. The reason we're talking about this now, and the reason I know about you is because you're part of this anthology, I suppose it is, this collection of different authors, different takes on the extraterrestrial UFO phenomenon, this book called Exposed, Uncovered, and Declassified UFOs and Aliens. You've got your section in that. You don't have to give it all away, but what are you saying in there?
Well, what I'm doing is pulling together... is not just my experience, but linking that with some other credible experiences that we hadn't heard of before, and maybe another experience that we have heard a little bit about, and putting the linkages together. In other words, drawing out these experiences and saying, here's why these experiences are happening, here's the connections with these experiences, this is the hypothesis that we should be able to consistently draw from these reports, and this is what we need to be doing in the future to move our understanding in a direction that will instill public confidence.
And are you hoping that what seems to be your very mature take on the events that occurred to you might bring out other people who've been through similar things?
I think so. I would encourage, I'm not encouraging people to go public with it. You know, I can understand if people just want to not say anything to anybody, but I don't want people to suffer in isolation with these experiences. And more to the point, I think that if we could do something to prepare ourselves to understanding how this relationship is unfolding with these other beings, and there's probably different species out there, that we could put institutions in place and training and education in place, that we could use that to help facilitate and development of a better relationship, and in fact encourage that relationship. So trying to reduce some of the stress of these experiences, and obviously try to find a way that we can invite some kind of experience with these beings in a way that we would find it a little bit easier to digest.
You got the distinct impression from them that they wanted to warn us about a fate we were walking into with our technology, but our mental capacity that doesn't go hand in hand with it. We're not great at learning as a species other than through calamity. Do you think that they would stop us from having a calamity caused by all of this, or do you think they'll let us have that experience because we have to?
They're going to let us have that experience because we have to, but they don't want us to go so far that we don't survive the experience.
So they want to seed enough enlightened people out there like you to make sure that, all right, we're going to go through whatever it might be, but there are going to be some people to carry on.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's going to be me. I'm not sure. I don't want to even think in that sense, but I'm not sure how their point is. I think that we need enough of us to carry on. I think we all individually have to take ownership for both what's right in the world and what's wrong in the world. I don't see myself bringing peace to the Middle East or anything like this. So it's just a matter of me doing my little thing in life and making sure that I think I'm doing the right thing.
Amazing story you've got. Thank you for telling it, Jim. Now, look, we all get in these situations. You sit on a plane assuming that you fly, and I think in Canada you probably have to get around to some of the vast distances you have in that great country. But you're sitting there, and there's somebody next to you, and they start talking, and they want to know about you. Question for you, do you tell them?
I don't tell them about the UFO stuff right at the
you
very
don't.
Beginning.
Okay. No, well, yeah, assuming, you know, you have maybe a gin and tonic, whatever you drink, the conversation gets going, you're an hour into the flight, you know more about the person, they want to know more about you, and something happens. Maybe there's an article in the paper that somebody's reading, and it brings you around to that kind of place. Do you go there?
I do, but I go there very carefully, you know, very gently. I don't want to push any of my ideas on anybody. You know, I feel if they're interested into an intelligent conversation or debate, certainly I would welcome that. But I go into it very cautiously, and I don't show all my cards at the very beginning, you know, not at all.
Have you lost friends or potential acquaintances, people that you might like to get to know because of this?
Not a one.
Not one?
Not
mm-hmm.
a one. And I think it's because of the way I approached it. You know, I never let it dominate a relationship. I never let it dominate a topic or a discussion. You know, I think my friends have always been my good friends, and they know me for who I am. And we talk about it a little bit. And I make jokes of it as well. So, you know, you have to have a good sense of humor with this kind of stuff too. So, and everybody has their different ideas about it. But I really try not to dominate the conversation or force my ideas or my belief systems on anybody.
For what it's worth, here's my reaction to it. And I don't think it's a bad one. I don't know what to think about this, but I'm sure as hell going to think about it. So I think you won. I think so.
That is really what we should be doing. And if I've accomplished that much, then I consider this to be a very, very good day.
Yeah, a good day indeed. Thank you for sharing your story, Jim Moroney. If people want to know about you, how do they do that?
They could check my website at aufosg.com.
Once more?
aufosg.com.
All right, Jim Moroney, anything else you'd like to say before we go?
Maybe an ending. I believe that we are entering into one of the most incredible journeys of the human history. And this is a journey not to be taken by the faint of hearted. And I really believe that we have people with tremendous courage and conviction. And I think that we are going to be able to make it through the most difficult times. And if this experience with extraterrestrials is part of that mystery, I believe that we have the capacity to understand it and even develop a great relationship with beings that I think we're going to have a very long-term relationship with.
Great to talk with you, Jim Maroney. I really enjoyed this, and I send my regards from this London to your London.
Thank you very much, and God bless.
Bit of a breathtaking story, eh? Jim Maroney from London, Ontario, Canada. A great guest here on The Unexplained. And there'll be more like that coming soon, is all I can say. Please give me your reaction to this show and all our shows. Any thoughts, suggestions, anything you'd like to do, please go to www.theunexplained.tv. That is our website. You can go to that particular location if you want to make a donation to the show. It's the location for donation. Sorry about that. We'll be back soon with another show. Micah Hanks will be our guest. He will talk about extraterrestrials and other stuff. And many more good shows coming up in the pipeline too. My name is Howard Hughes. Thank you to Adam Cornwell, a creative hotspot in Liverpool, for devising the website, getting the shows out to you, and all the other hard work he does. Martin, thank you for the theme tune, and thank you to you for listening to The Unexplained and being part of this. My name is Howard Hughes. I will return.